Hi guys, it's Heidi. We have a special two-part series diving into the migrant crisis at the border. If you've seen or heard anything on the news lately, chances are you've heard of it. You might have seen images of families in rafts attempting to cross the river, the haunting photos of those who have drowned in their attempts. You might have seen the thousands living in makeshift refugee camps under an overpass, or videos of immigration officers chasing down migrants on horses and with dogs. If you're anything like me, you've heard of the migrant crisis, but might have little understanding because it's such a sensitive topic. But you know in your gut that it's important to God and something needs to change. But often we don't know what to do, what to think, or even what to pray for. And the temptation is to resign and stay ignorant. But the first step into caring for what God cares for and being a part of what He is doing is to allow yourself to be moved. And one of the ways that we do that is through listening and engaging our minds and our hearts. We must get informed. That's why in this month's episode of Morning Coffee with PB, we're sitting down with Pastor Alma and Dr. Will of Practice Mercy. Practice Mercy is a grassroots organization that is committed to serving the Indigenous women and children who are seeking asylum in the U.S. and living in makeshift refugee camps at the border of Mexico. Pastor Alma is a living embodiment of what it means to live by faith in God and for the love of Christ and His people. She spends her days advocating for, serving, and walking alongside these Indigenous mothers in Reynosa, Mexico. Her ministry is a ministry of presence, so she goes into the camps each week to build slow and intentional relationships with these women and their children. In this first part, you'll be able to gather context and background to the refugee camps that have popped up on the Mexico side of the U.S.-Mexico border. This is a conversation that answers the questions of what is going on, why is this happening, and why is it crucial for us as Christ followers to witness, to understand, and to amplify the voices of those seeking asylum in our nation. We're so grateful that you're here. Let's join the conversation. Hello, everyone.
Hi.
Man, we're so excited.
We're in Texas.
Yeah. McAllen, Texas. We have such a special episode for you guys today.
We're in Texas, y'all. We got a big Texas-sized podcast for y'all.
And around the table today, we have two special guests. We have Pastor Alma in the house.
Come on.
Hey, I'm so thrilled to be with you guys.
Yes, and Dr. Will.
How are y'all doing?
Heidi, yeah. What are we doing here?
There's a border team from Echo that consists of Nixon, Ma, Kathleen, Jenny, and Sherry, and myself, and Pastor Brian. We came here to be witnesses to what Practice Mercy
is. I believe Nixon barely made the team, though. I just want to put that in there. Okay, sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
So we came here to McAllen, Texas to, really witness what Practice Mercy is doing here just with Pastor Alma. And, so how should
we? I think the way we should start is, Pastor Alma, can you explain to us what is happening here? Why is it, because I've heard you guys say over and over again, it's a humanitarian crisis. Mm-hmm. What is happening? Is it just people trying to get to U.S. for a better life? Or why is it such a crisis for us to even care about?
I think it is extremely important and was one of the first things that I share with faith communities in the United States. And in general, when I'm interviewed or when I have an opportunity to speak with anybody, the majority of the people we serve are people of faith, meaning the majority of the women and children that I serve as asylum seekers, people who are seeking refuge within our borders, are women of faith, meaning they're Christian evangelicals, they're Christian Catholics that are fleeing death threats or dangers for their children. So it's extremely important that we understand that, that these are people who care less if they go to the mall, care less if they have a nice car. What they want is for their children to have an opportunity for life. Yes. To live, not just to, have a better life or I go shopping. No, no, no. We are talking that...
Right, their dream is to literally live.
Yes.
Not have a dream.
No.
Their dream is to literally live.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, what is the difference between a refugee and an asylum seeker? Well, Dr. Will.
And just to add one more thing to what Alma was saying, like, this is largely a crisis that we've created. And, I mean, there are more people coming because there's been more more issues in Central America. But if you look over the last couple decades, there's always been a steady flow of migrants coming. But in the last couple years, we've tried to completely shut that down. And so then it looks like there's a much bigger issue. There's all these camps that rise up. But in reality, if you actually look at the numbers of immigration, it's not something that's way out of normal of what we've had over the last couple decades. But it's just that our policies have shifted, and so it looks like a crisis because it's one that we've really created ourselves.
When you say we've created, so if the numbers are not too extreme in terms of going up and down, what was the policy before and what is it now, or what was it just before this that created this mess?
Right. I mean, if you look back, even going back to the maybe, 5 years ago, most people that were coming in to seek asylum were allowed to stay in the U.S. Now, if they were single males, they would usually be detained. And so they might be in a detention center for a year or two, which was obviously not great. And if they were families, especially women with children, a lot of times they were released to wait in the U.S. until they had their court date.
With an ankle bracelet.
But it was largely people just being able to come through. And so there wasn't these scenes of thousands of people there at the border, because it would be, a couple hundred people a day, they would get processed. But starting in 2019, under the last administration, they said, we're not going to allow people to enter to seek asylum. They're going to have to wait in Mexico, which was the Remain in Mexico policy. And then it became even more extreme under COVID, where they said, we're just going to shut down the border altogether. You're not even going to get your name put on a list. You're just not going to be allowed to enter at all. And it's, as we've talked about, it's really complicated, because right now we really have both systems in place. So we have the original Remain in Mexico coming back as a policy, because the Supreme Court said they had to reinstate it, and we still have this Title 42 restriction due to coronavirus. And so what it's created, as y'all saw today, is just this mess on the other side.
Yeah.
And it's really created this bottleneck. And so the longer we wait to change the policy, when we actually do hopefully one day restore asylum and just go back to what we were doing 5 years ago, there is going to be a rush at the border initially, because we've created this mess.
This bottleneck, yeah.
Yeah, and so and the longer we wait, the bigger issue that's going to be.
Yeah.
And so when we say there's a crisis, I mean, I know I'm almost stealing this from Doug Padgett from the article he wrote. Like, the crisis is really our policies, and that's created this humanitarian issue.
As you listen to Dr. Will speaking about the camps that have popped up on the Mexico side of the U.S.-Mexico border, this is where Pastor Alma is ministering, and this is where our team from Echo was able to go. As you listen, I want you to imagine what we saw. You walk across the bridge from the United States into Mexico, and it looks like it could be really any other city. There's crosswalks and billboards, and a plaza with convenient shops and pharmacies. but you turn a busy street corner and suddenly the world is transformed. There's a fountain that looks like it would be in any bustling city center, but it's surrounded by people. There are tarps and tents creating makeshift homes. There are beds with teddy bears and fire trucks on them. Bras, socks, and t-shirts hang from ropes. And right there on the sidewalk is a fire on top of logs with a pan frying onions. There's a makeshift classroom with one blackboard and yoga mats for the children to sit. And there are so many children. A brother as young as 4 holds his infant sister and washes her face by the water basin. A child that looks as young as 2 just sits on the curb. And finally, a gazebo right in the heart of the refugee camp. It's a place where you'd imagine young lovers to sit and giggle. Now is covered with blue tarps, hosting and sheltering families seeking asylum. Inside, there are laundry in piles, blankets on concrete, a few inflatable mattresses. Families from different nations, sitting, waiting, wanting, wishing, hoping, praying for a chance to make it into the United States.
Dr. Will is saying he's so knowledgeable, and he is our immigration policy expert in Practice Mercy Foundation, and we depend on him to process the complexity of immigration policies. Yeah. And we see the people that we serve are what is called from the Northern Triangle, mm-hmm. Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, mm-hmm. a lot of Nicaraguans and Venezuelans mm-hmm. and Colombians and Cubans, of course. Mm-hmm. But you don't see people from Costa Rica at the border. You don't see people from Panama at the border. Mm-hmm. It's always the same 3 nations mm-hmm. that foreign policy, American foreign policy, has been heavily involved since the 20s, 30s, mm-hmm. 40s, 50s.
Can you explain that a little more? And you explained that to us earlier about how a lot of the issue was that we were involved there in that triangle, and then when we pulled out, it created a vacuum. And criminals and corruption came in, and much like what happened in Afghan when we left recently, mm-hmm. the Taliban was able to just take over overnight. Can you explain that a little bit? Because I think people don't know that a lot of the migration that's happening, often it's our fault that we got involved, yeah. and then we pillaged the place, like you were talking about the natural resources, and then when we vacated, it created such a vacuum of protection or you know, order that it allowed the criminals. Can you talk about that a little more?
What I saw is when I lived in Cuba, mm-hmm. you know, and my Cuban friends, once they found their faith in Christ, they will hear about, you know, because they learned in school about Che Guevara and Fidel Castro mm-hmm. and how they were involved in Guatemala and Central America to avoid what is called by communists Yankee imperialism. And I'm like, well, they're just communist talk.
Yankee.
Imperialism. Oh, yeah, wow. It's the communist talk in Cuba. Uh-huh. And I lived in Cuba. And so I will hear them talking mm-hmm. about it, and like the rest of the American society, we are very illiterate when it comes to world history mm-hmm. and what foreign policy means if we are not involved in it. Mm-hmm. We just vote according to whatever, you know, is like we all call for jury duty, but we don't really want to be there. Mm-hmm. It's what my perception, you mm-hmm. know, of the American people. Mm-hmm. So as a recent immigrant for me, and because of the nature of my service is as a field missionary, is the policies made in D.C. mean life or death to the people I serve. Mm. And as one of my teaching pastors says, I need to study the people I serve. I need to know why. We saw waves, You know, we saw in 2012, 2016, 2014. And I wasn't, my immigration process wasn't completed and it wasn't safe for me to be involved. I couldn't cross borders. And it's until recently that I'm safe doing that I got involved. But something that really got my attention is that my friends in the Middle East were asking me about the situation at the border. And I'm like, I'm not doing jack squat, right? That's an American saying, right? I'm not doing anything, you know, and I live at the border. And then I realized, you know, I calmed myself down and I said, well, it wasn't safe for me to be involved. Mm-hmm. I could get deported with them, right? And so now I'm safe to be able to cross borders. Mm-hmm. And now I'm able to say, I can do something about it.
Yeah.
And we is how providentially it has been organic. It has been relational. It has been grassroots. And this is a ministry. We have a submissions organization that is relational and is holistic.
Mm. Yeah. Pastor Alma, I don't know if you guys caught that, but she said things that happen in D.C. mean actual life and death for the people that she serves. And, you know, we often throw around the word or the term life and death situations, but you literally mean life and death for the people that you serve. Can you maybe help our people kind of understand what you mean by that? Like, maybe not get into the politics per se, but like what an example of that will look like.
Yeah, and I don't know much about politics. You know, that's why we have Dr. Will here to tell us about it. But means he mentioned Title 42. Thus, under the Trump administration, they created that. They invented that to avoid the people that request asylum, the opportunity to request asylum. To request asylum is legal under international law. Mm-hmm. If you present yourself at the port of entry, you can request asylum if you have a valid cause for fear of death. Mm-hmm. But what I see in my side of the border, there's a checkpoint in the middle of the bridge on international waters. Mm-hmm. That shouldn't be there. Yeah. And you have to prove that you have a document in order to keep going to the port of entry. Mm-hmm. So these people cannot reach the port of entry to request asylum. Mm-hmm. They have to go through the river. They get caught by American Immigration, Customs and Border Patrol, because they're supposed to do that. That's their job. They're doing a great job in doing that. And then they get processed and they get returned to Mexico. Mm. The Mexico border is so dangerous that it has a level 4 by Homeland Security, meaning that the levels of danger in Reynosa, Matamoros, Laredo is like Syria, like Damascus, Syria is that level. Mm. And so it is extremely dangerous for these people. And when we talk about organized crime, that's no joke. You have MS-13 in Central America. You have different cartels depending on the region in Mexico. Mm. And so the border towns are controlled by organized crime. Mm. Local gangs, MS-13, the different cartels that control the border. The cartel that controls Tijuana is very different from the one that controls Reynosa. And the one that controls Matamoros is different than Reynosa or Juarez. And so these people, in the summer, what... Customs and Border Patrol, we call them CBP, that they were doing is there were so many people crossing that they did lateral flights. What does that mean? Meaning, if they get caught in Reynosa, they will process them in McAllen, and then they will fly them to El Paso, and then they will expel them in Juarez. That's a different cartel. They will not honor for them to be able to cross again. They will get killed or kidnapped or raped or cut into pieces. The way that these people operate is dark and evil and demonic.
So hold on a second. So you're saying these folks that get caught, first of all, we made it so that the way they cross is illegal, mm-hmm. right? And then we catch them, and then when we deport them back, we think we're just sending them back to Mexico general, right? But then you're saying, when we send them back, we're sending them to a different gang or cartel jurisdiction, mm-hmm. right? And so they end up being deported back to a different area, and they don't have the right to be there?
Sometimes that happens.
By those gangs?
Mm-hmm. Like, sometimes they'll be deported to a different city. Sometimes they'll be deported to the same place. But they're also, as a couple of the ladies we're talking about today, they're at special risk because they're migrants. And so they're targeted by the cartels. They know that they're not from Mexico, mm-hmm. and they know that they're in a desperate situation. They don't have any protection. And they also know that they probably have family in the U.S. that they can blackmail to get money.
Yeah.
And so if you talk to most of the people we've worked with, they've been kidnapped at some point. Mm. It's almost just the, you know, to meet someone who hasn't been kidnapped is pretty rare.
Yeah.
And so we've set that system up where we just, you know, driving over here tonight, we saw some people getting picked up by Border Patrol right by the bridge. But they had to pay the cartel to cross the river so they could get picked up by Border Patrol. And so it's this thing where...
Vicious cycle.
Yeah. And we're it's almost like we're directly supporting the cartel. I mean, it's not even...
The U.S. government is essentially handing them money.
Right. I used to say it was like indirectly, but it's like it's so blatant that it's... You almost wonder sometimes, like, is there...
Yeah, and I just want to interject here because I think it's really hard to conceptualize this. Mm-hmm. When we hear, you know, we deport them back to Mexico, it's really hard to know that these are actual human beings with actual names mm-hmm. and statuses, but we just drop them in this country. And I didn't realize just how disorienting that is and how truly inhumane and dire that is when, until we actually crossed the border and, you know, we walked across the bridge and Pastor Alma, you know, pointed to some people who were, they had some dirt on their jeans and their pants and they just were sitting there and you just looking at them immediately, you would think like, oh, maybe they, you know, long day at work or something. They're just taking a break, but they were literally sitting there because they had been dropped into Mexico, into a part of a country that they don't recognize or they don't know, totally disoriented. They don't have any way of contacting the people who had helped them across. And it's happening right before our very eyes. And they have children with them. And they're just so confused. Like, where do you go from there?
I think for me, when I first came, guys, I thought these were Mexicans trying to cross. And then we just sent them back home. Mm-hmm. But I'm realizing that is not their home either, right? They're from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. Can you explain that a little more again? Why are they coming? Why are they escaping that triangle? Why are they not liked by Mexicans right here? And why are the indigenous persecuted or hated on?
Yeah, and I'll let Alma talk about the indigenous aspect. I would just add, from that Northern Triangle, a big part of this is been our imperialism over time, as Alma was mentioning, but it's also, I guess, another aspect of our imperialism, which is the war on drugs. You know, if you look back in the 1970s and 80s, most of the drug trade was coming through Miami, so it was coming, you know, straight from Colombia or Venezuela to Miami. We shut that down, and so these drug routes are going through Central America and Mexico. And so we have this big war on drugs. We also have a big drug market in the U.S. And so what ends up happening is these countries get ravaged in the process. And it's, you know, it's not an easy issue to solve in that way, mm-hmm. but it's something where we've allowed this organized crime just to grow more and more. And then the poverty that's with that as well. And so most of the people we talk to, it's a matter of poverty and it's a matter of security. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard to separate the two. There's this extreme poverty, but there's also this fear for their lives, for their children's lives. And it seems like the situation in Central America is not getting any better. It has some of the highest murder rates in the world. Like remembering it correctly, like Honduras had higher murder rates than Syria or Iraq.
Completely lawless. And it is something that we have created. We have created this horrible monster. And it's like the war of drugs and the drugs are coming. I understand if the United States wouldn't be the biggest drug market in the world, we wouldn't have cartels. America is the biggest drug market. You're talking a multi-billion drug business. So if America wouldn't consume so much drug, we wouldn't have cartels. So, you know, it's something that we have to consider. It's like, so,
and then we wouldn't have the poverty there, which then brings them down to escape poverty and danger. Right. So that's what you mean by we created our own mess.
When you walk through the camp, you can't help but ask yourself, who would choose to stay here? Reynosa, the city we are in, is itself rated as one of the most dangerous cities in Mexico. And it has a level 4 danger rating out of 5, equal to the threat of living in Iraq or Afghanistan. This is where the young mothers with children wait for their court date. Can you even begin to imagine what kind of violence they have fled to choose to stay here? And I use the word choice lightly. The term choice falls flat in this moment. These women have seen their husbands dismembered, fear being raped on their way to the market, have seen their children beaten or kidnapped by gangs. And here, even here, after all they've been through, they live in the constant fear of the local cartel. Let's just sit in this tension for a moment, knowing that this is the reality that our brothers and sisters live in just right outside our borders.
Creating instability for the governments that we have in the Northern Triangle. Because during the fruit companies thing, it's because I know this because of Cuba, right? So when Fidel and Che were in Guatemala, it's because American companies wanted the indigenous population to be removed because they wanted to own the most fertile land for their companies in the U.S., Chiquita Banana, and you name it, right? The fruit companies, that's what they called. And so we created, if we didn't like the president, we will create instability, right? I think we've seen enough movies to know that. Mm-hmm. And please don't tell me that you don't know where the cartel is. We have DEA. We have the best machines in the world. I mean, you know, we have the greatest minds. We have the greatest strategies. We have the greatest universities on earth. We certainly know who the cartel is, what they're doing, where they are. And so we can resolve that issue. But, you know, we have politicized and demonized immigration. It shouldn't be this way. Yeah. You know, migration is necessary. You know, I've been joking with Dr. Will recently. It's like, can you imagine a Cinco de Mayo without tacos? A Cinco de Mayo without Corona? Yeah. A Cinco de Mayo if we can start just awareness. I'm not using the word protest, but awareness of the richness that the Latino culture can bring to the United States. Can you imagine if Texas and California said, okay, on Cinco de Mayo, even Taco Bell is going to close. You won't have margaritas, you won't have mojitos, you won't have Corona, you won't have tacos, you won't have nachos on Cinco de Mayo until you resolve the immigration issue, until we can create immigration reformed. That will get people's attention, even if you don't want to talk about immigration. Yeah. And also, you know, you have these people paying $10,000 for a Honduran boy to be dropped up in Houston. Okay, what about if we can create a visa system where if the boy has relatives in the United States that can take care of him, he can apply for a work visa for a year and it's going to cost you $10,000. These people will go to the United States Embassy and they will apply and they will go through all the red tape because they want to do things legally. They want to work, they want to save their lives, they want to save their children's lives. Certainly, we have the intelligence and the resources to create a system that can make a way for it.
I want to ask maybe a more theological question. Why do you think, I guess maybe I can pose it this way, How would you talk to someone who didn't believe that this was a Christian issue? Or maybe someone who just, because, you know, it's such a hot topic. It's like, you know, you almost like tune out because you're like, I don't know what to do about this situation. How would you talk to someone who maybe would be coming from that place? Or like maybe what is a common misconception that Christians often face? Because we're finding that most of the Christians in the United States are the most vocal against migrants, right. You know?
Yeah, that's, you know, one of the sad ironies where, like, as a whole, the church has been the most antagonistic. But there's also the people that are usually on the ground doing the work. And so it's like this strange world where there's both extremes with that. And I would say that it's really hard looking at the Christian scriptures to get away from the centrality of how we're supposed to treat the foreigner and our stance on immigration. Now, if you look at some other faith traditions, they might vaguely talk about immigration. You kind of have to really dig and read between the lines, where in Christianity, it's so blatant. You know, Jesus was a refugee child going to Egypt. Like, it's all throughout the scriptures. And so I think to just say it's not a Christian issue, it's hard to read through the Gospels, especially the Gospel of Luke, and then just be like, oh, it's not important to the Christian faith. And so I'm wondering if...
But what about those Christians that are like, are we supporting illegal immigration? Like, you know, there's no rule of law. And then there's some Christians that are like, well, to support them means to not support jobs in America for Americans. Like, all of that talk that gets in the way of addressing the real human issue of immigration.
Right. And I, you know, the issue, and I'll let Alma talk about the issue of legality, but I think when it comes to jobs, and I was talking to Nixon about this earlier, but, you know, the Christian response should be, even if it was in some ways putting us at a disadvantage to help out other people, it should still be the Christian position to help out those in desperation. But it's actually the opposite, that our anti-immigrant policies are hurting us economically, which is one of the reasons why there's a lot of economists that are both like conservative and progressive that say they want more immigration because it makes sense economically. I was just at a talk with a professor from Texas Tech, a very right-leaning professor. He wrote a book called, like, Socialism Sucks. Like, he's on Fox News. But he also wrote a book about why we have to massively expand immigration. He's like, this is the only way to actually grow our economy, because we need more people. We need more people to grow the economy. And so I think that issue about jobs has never really been, it's been a political issue that politicians have jumped on, but from a lot of people that are studying economics and people that are actually looking at the numbers, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because yes, the way I put it is, like, immigrants do take jobs, but they also create jobs. Like, there's not a static number of jobs in the society. When you have a bigger population,
it's not a zero-sum game.
Right, more jobs are created. And I think right now, especially, we keep talking about there's a labor shortage and we can't find workers. And part of the issue, you know, all the issues with COVID, a part of it is we've shut down so much immigration, both with asylum seekers and just work visas and green cards.
That's right, yeah.
And our population's not growing internally because, you know, our birth rates are very low. And so for our society and our economy to survive, we actually need more immigration. I think we need to expand it in a very large way, not just allow a few more people in. And so, but again, going back to the Christian perspective, even if it was putting us at a disadvantage, that shouldn't be like our main concern. But I know, Alma, the issue of, like, they're not doing things legally, or these are, we're supporting illegal immigration. How would you respond to someone saying that?
If we say we are followers of Jesus, then we have to live our faith. When we say we're Christians, that's a big responsibility. When we see a Muslim woman, we know she's Muslim because of her dress, the majority of how she eats. With Buddhist or with Hindus, it's the same way. As followers of Jesus, as Christ followers, we need to live our faith. And our faith shaping our politics, no politics shaping our faith. And I think Western Christians, we need to revisit how we live our faith. Are we following Jesus like we follow somebody on Twitter? Then you're a fan. Don't say you're Christian if you cannot live your faith.
Are you preaching it?
So it is extremely important to do that. And I'm not, you know, I'm not just challenging anybody, but the Lord says in the scriptures, and it's in writing, that we need to love our Lord. We need to love Jesus with our mind, with our hearts, with our soul, right? And we have a humanitarian crisis. We should care. You know, we should care what's happening. Even if we cannot do anything, we can pray for them. But the majority of the people we serve are Christian evangelicals or Christian Catholics. So they're people of faith in need. And I think I mentioned to you guys that I think at this point, and I don't have all the statistics, I hope the brilliant Dr. Will can help me with that later, but I think we are at the point that we are in the equivalency of the crisis that we face receiving refugees on the Second World War II, with Anne Frank was rejected and was returned to Germany and killed eventually. I think we're at that point. We have thousands of people. We have thousands of brothers and sisters in Christ that are waiting to request asylum in Mexico. And we have moles in refugee camps from MS-13 and cartel preying on them. And it's time we make a decision. Are we going to follow Christ? If you say you're a Christian, you have to leave your faith. And your faith is in writing. We have the Holy Scriptures to guide our lifestyle. And we have to shape our faith, and we have to shape our lives according to the Scriptures. Not the politics, whatever you are, red or blue or independent, that doesn't shape your faith or your life or your decisions. It has to be all the way around.
In Deuteronomy 10:18-19, it is written, "He defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow, and loves the foreigner residing among you, giving them food and clothing. And you are to love those who are foreigners, for you yourselves were foreigners in Egypt." Amen.
Hearing is like, it's funny because like the border issue, they're literally our neighbors,
right?
And it's so funny because churches love to send people far away.
Oh yes,
but we don't like to do what's like literally our neighbor. We want to bless neighbors across the, you know, across the sea, but we don't want to really see the neighbor next to us. What I'm hearing you saying, Pastor Alma, is like, this, the immigration asylum issue and all the humanitarian crisis down on the border, this is more, this is beyond politics. This is beyond, you know, legal issues. This is really about our allegiance to Christ.
Yes.
And what you're saying is whatever the politics is, whatever happens to it, it doesn't matter. What we need to do right now is respond.
Yes.
Respond with mercy.
Yes.
And when you guys were talking, it reminded me of how the early church, before the doctrines were all set, the creeds were all set, they couldn't agree on a lot of the doctrines. But they agreed that as a Christian, one thing that all movements of Christianity agreed on was that a Christian was hospitable.
Yes.
Right? But they couldn't agree on every item and every line of the creeds. But one thing was, we are a hospitable movement. We're a hospitable people. The kingdom of God is a hospitable culture.
Right.
And so it's interesting how, you know, when you read when you read about like America is, you know, we think we're a Christian nation, but we are the most inhospitable nation, literally.
Right.
We don't want to host anyone. We don't want to house anyone. We don't want to welcome anyone. And so the irony of that is just so amazing. Like, we say we are followers of God who is hospitable, and we don't want to be hospitable.
Right. I mean, I don't remember who was praying today on the river, and they made this really important point that, you know, the river is God's, and we've decided that it's ours. And so it's this idea of that we have this ultimate say of the land and the river. Yeah. And I was just talking to Alma about this on the way over. Like, I feel like the hymn, This Is Our Father's World, right? That should be like this very pro-immigration song. I don't think maybe a lot of people interpret it that way. But
yeah,
if the earth is ultimately God's, then that should reframe how we see immigration and the idea of that we're not going to allow people who are desperate to cross God's land because we own it. I think if we could just reframe some of that pride and that arrogance we have, it might reframe how we see immigration and those that are like wanting to migrate. Because, you know, throughout world history, migration is very natural. And we've made it this big controversy. And even in U.S. history, and this is one thing I like to talk to my students about a lot, is that throughout most of U.S. history, we had open borders. And so you think about people coming from Europe, Ellis Island, a lot of people, sometimes it was 99% of people were allowed in. So you just got on a boat, you were allowed in. Same thing with Angel Island in San Francisco. And even the Mexican-American border, most of the time people were just allowed to come in. They weren't even necessarily stopped by agents. And so this idea of we're just going to have this extreme restrictions really began at the beginning of the 20th century. So even in the history of the U.S., it's a relatively new phenomenon. It doesn't mean like immigrants were treated well when they got here. Like there was a lot of discrimination inside the nation. But actually coming into the country was fairly easy. And now with the, you know, in our current era, it's like this, we're having these conversations. Are we going to let people that are desperately fleeing enter our borders? And it does seem as, in a way that we're saying, you know, God doesn't control this land. Like this is not God's world. We'll do whatever we want. So I do think faith comes into that as well.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the river because we started today by visiting the Rio Grande River, and that area is so deeply humbling, and it just it's a weird thin place. You know, we left a touristy kind of American bar situation, and just across the river you see rafts that have been like the remnants of rafts of people trying to cross this river washed up on the sides, and you see these giant mansions on the Mexico side with these like intricate playgrounds and beautiful outdoor fireplaces. And then you see a military boat zipping through and causing all this, like all these waves. And it's this weird place where I found myself wondering how in the world I was lucky enough to be born on this side of the river. And PB actually started today, we started the day with prayer, and he was like, really, it's just a matter of where you're born. Like, it's just, and that's so deeply humbling, and that felt so profoundly real when we saw the river, and we saw, you just see all these different worlds colliding at this place, and it's just across the river.
And then you finish your day walking by the sidewalk where thousands of people are waiting for hope and life. And then you prayed for people who are fleeing for the sake of their children. And as I repeat it, you know, for me, number one is the majority of the people, the majority of the women that we serve and that are fleeing horrific violence, gender violence, child bride situations, rape, threats of kidnapping for their children are Christian evangelicals or Christian Catholics.
Yeah. As we end the first part of our two-part series, I want to bring you to the waters of this river we just talked about. The Rio Grande that runs between Mexico and the United States. Because of the U.S. military being stationed at the border, inhibiting legitimate asylum seekers to cross and request asylum in our nation, many pay the cartel to attempt to cross the rivers at night. The majority of asylum seekers don't know how to swim, so those who fall out of the rafts often drown. Others are picked up by Border Patrol in motorboats, and the very few who cross are often picked up by immigration on the other side and sent back to Mexico. Even still, one mother said that she would rather die in the river than go back to where she fled from. Many mothers send their children across at night, hoping they will make it to U.S. soil. I want you to picture it with us, this river. America on one side, Mexico on the other. I want you to picture what it would be like to send your young child across. Your child who has never had a swim lesson a day in their life. Here in the daylight on the U.S. side, we have a restaurant playing Christmas music. You can drink a Coke while sitting by the waters. You can ride a tour boat, and as you skim the tops of the waters, you can see the sides littered with remnants of rafts. You wave to the immigration officers patrolling the waters in speedboats. You see parts of the unfinished border wall. On the Mexico side, you see vacant mansions, the lifestyles of the rich who vacation there in the summers. You wave hello to the Mexican soldiers sitting in their light white and gray uniforms. So much life and death collide in this river. This river that provides water for cities and irrigates farmlands as she flows. As we close this first part, I'd like to end with a poem written on the waters of the Rio Grande River. To live and die in this river. Sides littered with green rafts of those who have tried to cross these treacherous waters. In hope that you can see, but can't reach. To live and die by this river. Waters touched by the feet of tourists kicking in the heavy sun. Laughing, smoking, listening to Christmas carols. To live and die on this river, torrents caused by angry boats looking for signs of life, not to save, but to silence. To live and die at this river happens to depend on what side of the waters you were lucky to be born on. Thank you for joining us for this first part of this two-part series. Join us next time as we hear from the women themselves, how we as a church got connected to practice mercy, and how we can continue to partner with what God is doing right now at the border. Until next time, bye.